Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at the CIA and the media in the United States. We'll be joined by journalist, author, and professor Brian Covert, longtime contributor to Project Censored. We'll be looking at a recent chapter he did called Played by the Mighty Wurlitzer, The Press, the CIA, and Subversion of Truth. We'll also talk more about the CIA and media history in the U.S. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, Played by the Mighty Wurlitzer, The Press, the CIA, and the Subversion of Truth. For the hour, we'll be joined by journalist, author, and professor Brian Covert, a longtime contributor to Project Censored. We'll be discussing his latest chapter on the CIA and media history in Censored 2017. Before we do that, however, here is Peter to introduce our guest to you. Peter?
Brian Covert is an independent journalist and an author based in Japan. He has worked for United Press International and News Service in Japan, and as a staff and reporter for the English-language daily newspapers in Japan, contributed to Japanese and overseas newspapers and magazines. He is currently a lecturer at the Department of Media, Journalism, and Communications at Toshisha University in Kyoto. Welcome, Brian.
Good afternoon, Peter. Good afternoon, Mickey.
You have a chapter in our book called Played by the Mighty Wurlitzer, The Press, the CIA, and the Subversion of Truth. What do you mean by the Mighty Wurlitzer?
Well, the Mighty Wurlitzer is the nickname which the CIA itself gave to this propaganda machine within the agency back in the 1940s onward, in which it would foster relations with reporters and news companies and put a message out there, much like the Wurlitzer organ was used in silent movie days to kind of play the background soundtrack of what was going on the screen. The press was used as a kind of mighty Wurlitzer to get the CIA's message out or the U.S. government's message out about what was happening in the world in the form of favorable news stories and various forms of propaganda. The Mighty Wurlitzer was literally the CIA's in-house propaganda machine, but that's the nickname they gave it.
And Brian Covert, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. We've had you on before for your stellar reporting on Fukushima. You've also published, of course, with us over the years, Mandela, work on Mandela that mentions, of course, the CIA and their happenings in South Africa. You've also done research with us on whistleblowers, Gary Webb and the CIA. And again, here you are returning in Censored 2017 with another entire chapter on the CIA and the media. And let's kind of go back and look at some of this history, because you do this quite deftly in a chapter. Naturally, there have been certainly books that have tackled this. Not long ago, we had Nick Scow on the program. His book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, along with David Talbot and Hot Books. Definitely some overlap there, but you go through, I think, and look at some different connections and some pretty specific historical connections. So could we go through and talk a little bit about the history of what you found and, you know, researching this? Because this was a very fascinating research project for you.
Yes, well, actually the project started when I was working on the Gary Webb Dark Alliance piece for Censored 2016, and during my research and investigation, I was coming up again and again with the cases of the CIA and the press working together, some of which I had heard about and some of which I hadn't. So I decided for the next Censored book, Censored 2017, that we would go deeper into that and see what we could find. There's a disturbing history of the press cooperating with the CIA, especially. And it goes much deeper, I think, than most of us are aware, and I bring up several cases of that in the book. For example, the issue of brainwashing, what we know today as brainwashing, where, for example, a government agency would put something into people's heads and try to get them to change their minds. That term, brainwashing, actually came about from a CIA agent who was a journalist originally, Edward Hunter, based in New York back in the 1940s and 50s. And he worked closely with the CIA. He was working for the CIA for at least 1 year that I could find. And he went off and wrote a book called Brainwashing in Red China, published in 1951. And in his book from that point on, Edward Hunter warned the world that China was up to no good. It was undertaking a program of mind control, mass mind control of the Chinese populace, trying to convert them to communism. And that's why most Chinese people were accepting communism, because they were being mentally forced to do that. This is what Edward Hunter was proposing in his news articles, and this was printed in the American press. So the issue of brainwashing first came up in the Miami Daily News in September of 1950. That's where the word brainwashing as we know it first came up. And from there, it just took off from the year 1950 all the way through 1959 and beyond. The 50s was basically the decade of brainwashing in the United States. And
Brian Covert, yeah. I just wanted to interject briefly, because it's interesting that you go through this history in the chapter here on brainwashing, and you're bringing it up contextually in the 1950s, and you're talking about how people were being swayed, brainwashed into a communist ideology. Ironically, isn't that the same time that the CIA was involved in MKUltra?
That's right. Actually, MKUltra came just after that point, when Allen Dulles declared a quote-unquote brain warfare front against America's enemies. Yes, but the MKUltra did come just after that point in the 1950s, and the whole brainwashing kind of scare actually was the impetus for the CIA to get deeper into MKUltra and the other mind control issues. But the point being that the whole issue of brainwashing as we know it today was not something that was invented by sociologists. It came up by a CIA agent who had originally been a journalist. And Edward Hunter is just one of the cases that we talk about in the book. There is this deeply disturbing working relationship between the press as an industry, with individuals, of course, and press companies, with the CIA from the 1940s onward, all the way up steadily through the 1950s, the 1960s, and in the 1970s, it began to be exposed by the corporate press, by the independent alternative press, and that's where things started falling apart, even though we know that the CIA and the press kind of still work together, formally anyway, through the Church investigation of the 1970s, that so-called Mighty Wurlitzer program was basically, they say, broken up and no longer as effective as it was before as a propaganda organ.
We can certainly revisit that momentarily, and we definitely want to come back to the Pike and Church committee hearings that you write about in the chapter. I wanted, however, to just not to be stuck in the past, but as an historian, I suppose I have a sort of a bias for that a little bit anyway in terms of how it informs the present. You write about Hunter and how he worked for a psychological warfare division called the Office of Policy Coordination.
Yes, the Office of Policy Coordination was basically where the whole CIA media propaganda network was operated from. And that was operated within the CIA by a high-level deputy director of the CIA by the name of Frank Wisner. Mm-hmm. He was the chief architect of the whole Mighty Wurlitzer propaganda network with the CIA and the media, both in the U.S. domestically and overseas. So the Office of Policy Coordination was really where everything was centered with the U.S. and the media, and it was, by all accounts, a very effective operation. It had a budget of millions of dollars and hundreds, if not thousands, of CIA agents working in CIA stations around the world with one aim, and that was to influence the course of news or to slant the news, to get the media to work the news to the CIA's liking. And at that time, we're talking about the 1940s and 50s, there was a very decided anti-communistic tone to news reporting, even by the mainstream press, so-called mainstream press, back then. So that was the heart and soul, really, of the media propaganda network by the CIA, was this Office of Policy Coordination. As far as we know, that Office of Policy Coordination no longer exists, and the program...
They just call it the CIA now?
Yeah, well, they do it now through the Public Affairs Office. Everything is done now formally through the Public Affairs Office of the CIA with the media. And that's how they work the press now, formally with a press agent who is used to kind of keeping good contacts with various journalists. And there are a number of them out there, including one that was exposed just a few years ago by the name of Ken Delanian, who used to work for the LA Times, is now working for MSNBC, and is currently involved in the big Russian hacking scandal that is coming up with Trump and Clinton and all that. Ken Delanian was exposed by The Intercept online magazine just a few years ago, 2014, as having worked very closely with the CIA in the shaping of his news stories for the Los Angeles Times. Now, this was, according to press accounts, even against the LA Times' own ethics policy, but he would be showing the CIA agents or press officers the full drafts of his stories, and would be asking the CIA for input, promising the CIA that he would be able to get them a good spin on the story, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not something that has just expired decades ago. It goes on today in various forms, and we see it today in the situation with this, I don't know what you would call it. It's just
well, the Mighty Wurlitzer plays on.
Right, the Mighty Wurlitzer just plays on in the form of this, for example, the Russian hacking scandal, which nobody seems to be able to produce evidence of, not much anyway. And it would be reasonable to assume that the CIA has some hand behind that, with the press playing right along. So the legacy goes on. The Mighty Wurlitzer lives on and in various forms, not the same form, but it does go on, and the press is still being played today by not only the CIA, but other intelligence agencies too. That is the history of the thing, and bringing it up to date, it is disturbing that the press, as an industry, as a pillar of a democratic society, would play along with this, but that's exactly what we're seeing. So Nick Scow and David Talbot and some of the others that you've had on your show have put this in context very well. It's incumbent upon all of us to be aware that it does go on, and in the era of so-called fake news, it's not really easy to know what is fake news and what is not, although I would like to think that people who listen to the Project Censored radio show are much more media savvy than the people who don't. But we've got our work cut out for us in the years ahead in trying to really expose the connection between the CIA and the press as it plays out today in the 21st century.
Brian, certainly we know from our own research that the big public relation firms like Omnicom and Hill & Knowlton do contract with the CIA to put out supposedly press releases or, in fact, create stories, sometimes stories that are false, and to put out in media worldwide. And this goes back, of course, to Harry Kern, who was at Newsweek magazine back in the 50s. Talk a little bit about him.
Yes, it's a very interesting story. Harry Kern was a senior editor of Newsweek magazine back from the 1930s, after he got out of university, up through the 1950s, and he was a high-level editor who was especially active in coverage of Japan at that time, the U.S. occupation of Japan under General MacArthur back in the late 1940s and 1950s. And Harry Kern was probably one of those elite journalists who had very close ties with the CIA, all the way to the top of the agency, all the way to a CIA director, Alan Dulles. He was on a first-name basis with Alan Dulles, by the way, and was able to propose ideas to Alan Dulles, get Alan Dulles' idea about what was going on in the world, and even set up meetings with him. And after leaving Newsweek back in the 1950s, he continued his close relationship with the CIA and Wall Street and Washington, and kind of stayed up in that elite level of journalists who had worked with the agency and continued working with the agency after he left journalism. He left journalism in 1956 and opened up his own consulting firm in New York, and then was still working for the CIA at that time that we could track. And he kept those high-level connections all the way up through the 1960s and into the 1970s when President Jimmy Carter was elected. Harry Kern had a direct line to President Jimmy Carter through Zbigniew Brzezinski, former National Security Council director under Carter, and was able to get the ear of the Carter administration on various issues concerning the Middle East and Japan. Back in 1979, Harry Kern found himself in the center of this major scandal here in Japan involving the Grumman Corporation, which is a military aircraft maker heavily connected with the military-industrial complex. And Harry Kern, it appears, was serving as a go-between between the Japanese government and military and the Grumman Corporation. And that kind of murky connection came out in 1979 in a parliamentary investigation here in Japan. So Harry Kern became a kind of household name here in Japan, although most Americans probably would not even know his name. But he was well-known, is still well-known. From time to time, you hear of Japanese journalists referring to Harry Kern doing this and doing that back in the days of Eisenhower. So Harry Kern, to make a long story short, was not found guilty of anything. Nobody was found guilty of anything in the big Grumman scandal back in 1979, 1980. And the issue just kind of went away. And then there were other issues concerning military aircraft makers. The Lockheed scandal followed not long after that. So there's this long history of Harry Kern working closely with the agency. And that all got kind of exposed in the mid-1970s when Carl Bernstein, formerly of the Washington Post.
Brian Cover, I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's talk about that. But before we do that, I wanted to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. And our guest for the hour today is Brian Cover, an independent journalist, an author, and a professor. And he is a lecturer at the Department of Media Journalism and Communication at Doshisha University in Kyoto. We'll continue our conversation about the CIA and media in the United States after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we are joined by independent journalist and author Brian Covert. He's a longtime contributor to Project Censored's books over the past years. We're talking specifically about his newest contribution, Played by the Mighty Wurlitzer, The Press, the CIA, and the Subversion of Truth. Brian Covert, before the break, we were talking a little bit more about the history of the CIA and Kern, and you had mentioned really a seminal bit that was published in 1977 by Rolling Stone by Carl Bernstein. And do you want to pick up where you left off?
Yes, we were talking about, at that time, what was the biggest expose of the CIA in the media cooperation by Carl Bernstein, who was known as the former Watergate reporter for the Washington Post, along with Bob Woodward. Bernstein wrote in his Rolling Stone article back in 1977 about the close ties with the CIA and the U.S. press. And from what Bernstein could find, about 400 journalists working for the big media companies served as having some kind of connection with the CIA over the years. And that was about 10 times more than the CIA even had admitted at the time. So Bernstein talked about the relationship with how the CIA had set up media front companies, for example, around the world. The CBS television network had a very close relationship at the highest levels between William Paley, who was the CBS president at the time, and CIA director Alan Dulles. But what Carl Bernstein wrote about it in that article was especially about the New York Times. The New York Times was undoubtedly the best media asset the CIA ever had, along with the Washington Post. But there was a special relationship between the CIA and the New York Times in the form of close connections between Alan Dulles, its director of the CIA, and Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who was the publisher of the New York Times at the time. And Sulzberger and Dulles worked on a scheme where New York Times would hire CIA agents and let them work undercover as reporters, and vice versa, that American reporters would have a very close contact with the CIA itself, and other things that Bernstein wrote about in his remarkable piece for Rolling Stone that really stands out still today, even after all these years, for really having lifted the lid and exposed the complicity of the U.S. corporate press with the CIA.
You note, though, Brian Covert, that Bernstein didn't go into much detail about the Washington Post.
No, he did not. One wonders why he didn't, but he went into a little bit about it, but not much. And we all know that the Washington Post also had a very close relationship with the CIA, but in a different sort of way. The Washington Post's relationship with Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner, who was the chief architect of the Mighty Wurlitzer propaganda machine, they were close friends. They worked. They moved in the same social circles as the Grahams of the Washington Post and
Philip and Catherine Graham.
Right. Philip and Catherine Graham of the Washington Post and other people at that level. They were close friends. They were confidants. And so there was no line between friendship and propaganda. It was just a matter of kind of keeping the friendship and not breaking the ties between, for example, the Washington Post and the CIA. So the Washington Post's relationship with the CIA is a bit different, more social in a sense than the New York Times was. But they were definitely working closely together in various levels, yes.
Let's leapfrog a moment just because in the news lately, quote unquote, you can use aerial quotes, I guess, the Washington Post in particular, now owned by Jeffrey Bezos, Amazon, right, just after acquiring the Post, was involved in $600 million of contracts between the CIA and Amazon. So, I mean, there appears to be some kind of business connection, contract connection, something going on there. I suppose one would argue about firewalls and the sort, but that's certainly something that we've written about. We wrote about it in the last Censored book, and it's something that's been coming up again lately because in its zeal to sort of hop on the, quote, fake news bandwagon, the Washington Post has been caught at least twice in the past month promoting false stories or promoting bogus stories, poorly researched stories. One would be the Prop or Not website that claims to have fake news sites that then put a whole slew of independent websites on there that are not fake news sites at all, including truthout.org, of all places. And as well, they were not long ago caught promoting the fake hacking story in a Vermont power grid that the Russians allegedly hacked, that it turned out they didn't even contact the power company until after they ran the story, and they had to retract it and were even called out by Forbes magazine. So, I mean, in this sense, at least one, given this long history that you're talking about, one has to wonder if the specter of the CIA doesn't still haunt places like the Washington Post.
Exactly. We can assume that it does because the Washington Post relies heavily on the CIA for its source information. It always has, and it probably always will. But we can assume, yes, that the Washington Post at least references some of this fake news information to the CIA itself, comes straight from the CIA. It certainly looks that way when you consider the relationship of the Washington Post and the CIA. So the legacy of the Mighty Wurlitzer continues today in what we see now as the fake news.
And fake news is just propaganda. It's like alt-right.
Right.
I mean, it's like dog whistle. You know, fake news is propaganda. The fact that it now has some kind of new label and it's being attached or affixed to the Russians or some Macedonian teenagers that are trying to flummox U.S. democracy, well, it seems fairly far-fetched, at least in its current propagandistic manifestation, given the factual history you're laying out here in the chapter. Peter?
Well, certainly, Brian, in the 70s, some of this was exposed. We learned the terminology Mockingbird, which was the CIA's term for journalists who were paid by them. They promised they weren't going to do this. But do you think that promise has been kept?
Not for a moment. The relationship between the press and the CIA, as we know it now, continued through the 1970s, through the 1980s, during the Reagan era, and certainly into the 1990s, around the time of Gary Webb's Dark Alliance and all of that. So no, it has never been separated, the relationship between the CIA and the media. And from time to time, every few years, that's a pattern that came up in the research I was doing, was that every few years, some big scandal would come up talking about the CIA and the media working together. It would get some coverage, and then it might get a congressional investigation or not, and then it would just die down and disappear. And then a few years later, the issue would come up again with the CIA and the media, and the whole cycle would repeat. So nothing has changed since the 1970s and in the 80s since then. So the press and the CIA have what is called an inseparable relationship, but that's the Washington Post's own term, and it has never been broken to this day. It's just changed. The nature of the relationship has changed, but the way it works has not changed. And as Mickey was just saying, we can assume that some of that CIA propaganda techniques are being used by the Washington Post even today, and certainly other media companies as well.
The Council of Foreign Relations did a report a decade ago calling for making intelligence smarter, which was even that taking more risks. And so they certainly weren't telling the CIA not to be involved with the media, but I think greater connections were encouraged.
That's right. That's right. The Council on Foreign Relations, which is the largest think tank in the U.S., wanted to see more closer relationship between the media and the CIA. And on that panel, compiling that foreign relations report, were some people working for the big media companies, such as the Washington Post. Surprise, surprise. So the Council on Foreign Relations, even the U.S. congressional committees that were formed in the 1970s to look into some of these things really did not even question the need for the press and the CIA to work together. They just covered what the relationship should be. And there has never been any call by the U.S. Congress in all of its investigations for the CIA and the news media to cut relations, to cut ties. It's never happened. And a lot of people, both Democrats and Republicans at that level, hesitate to even call for such a thing or even to criticize the CIA use of the media. So it goes on without even Congress questioning anything, and the Democrats are just as guilty as the Republicans for that.
Indeed, Brian Covert, President Barack Obama just recently signed the National Defense Authorization Act, and it includes something called Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act, and there is an entire section of it that creates a center with the Defense Department and the State Department to, quote, counter foreign propaganda. I mean, in and of itself, it's so nebulously and vaguely worded that inevitably it means really kind of overseeing information, being a so-called Ministry of Truth. Have you read any of this? I know this is a more recent development signed on Christmas Eve.
Yes, I've been following that, and it's very disturbing that the Obama administration would create this kind of thing ostensibly to, you know, counter Russia hacking into the U.S. elections and other things. It's very disturbing that the Obama administration would set that up in the first place, and we can bet that the Trump administration, incoming Trump administration, will use that, not altogether for good purposes. It's something that we all have to be worried about, in my opinion, that if it becomes a fact that media companies or journalists cannot write something without having to be watched or go through some government agency, that's very disturbing. And not unlike what, for example, happens in the former Soviet Union. Yes, President Obama is leaving us a gift with this new project that he's just set up, and let us just hope that it does not do any great damage to the independence of the news media in the United States.
And Brian Covert, prior to the NDAA, the Obama administration had something called the Counterintelligence Act, and there were several sections of it that create, quote, a committee to counter active measures by the Russian Federation to exert covert influence over peoples and governments. It's Cold War redux, I mean, on so many different levels here.
It is indeed, and it seems that the Obama administration is intent on reviving the Cold War again. We all thought we had enough of that back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, but apparently the U.S. government hasn't. So, yes, it's moving on again, and now we're in a position where Russia and China, too, are once again the evil empires that the U.S. has to face down. And, of course, the press will play a very important role in that. And we should also always keep in mind that there's this idea that the media kind of are working as spies in the U.S. government. It's really not like that. There's just this close relationship between the U.S. press and the centers of power, centers of political power, economic power, and the intelligence agencies. And the media companies want to get the story. They foster good relationship with the agencies, and the agencies use the media to get their word out. So it is the Cold War redux, and it's very disconcerting that it's all playing out again in much the same way.
Well, Brian Covert, I wanted to mention one more thing. We did mention the NDAA, and I just wanted to let listeners know, if they weren't familiar with this, Rick Sterling wrote about this at consortiumnews.com, the war against alternative information. And we have something called the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act. It's part of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2017. And I urge listeners to explore that or research that. Brian, you said you'd been following some of what's been going on inside this. And there are specific sections that actually call for this engagement center, as it's referred to. So in many ways, this is, a return or a redux to Cold War. And it kind of also then reminds us of what we learned about in the 1970s specifically after the Frank Church Committee. And you write about that in your chapter as well. And that's where we learned a lot early on, not necessarily for the first time. You reference a book on the invisible government, precursor to the deep state from the 1960s and so forth. But certainly in a major or official capacity, it really is the post-Watergate years that kind of cracks this open and gives us a peek at the deep state CIA media connection.
That's right. And let us hope that the same thing does happen again, that there are some intrepid journalists out there who will break open the system, crack open the system just enough to get all of this information out, the relationship between the press and various government agencies. That's what I'm hoping will come of all this, is that along with all of the media control that we'll be seeing certainly under the Trump administration, there will be good investigative journalism coming up that will expose this. And it does come up from time to time, but certainly not enough.
I think what we're looking at, too, here is the history, Brian Covert, that there was direct links between the CIA and various media groups around the world, and that was somewhat exposed in the 70s. But in a sense, they've really privatized that in that they work closely with these massive public relations and propaganda firms like WPP, which has 190,000 employees, 3,000 agencies all over the world. They subcontract with the State Department, the International Monetary Fund, the World Economic Forum. So they're doing government propaganda. And one of their subsidiaries, Hill & Knowlton, is known in terms of supporting the CIA and releasing information that they want to see released. So we have this intermediary group. So a PR firm, public relations propaganda firm, in fact, does a press release. It may have originated or sourced out of the CIA, but it comes from them to a major media corporation, and they say, oh, this is just a press release. Does that make sense to you?
It certainly does happen. It does go on. And you write about that well, Peter, in the latest book, Centered 2017, about selling empire, war, and capitalism. Propaganda has become privatized. What used to be kind of the domain of the CIA through its Office of Policy Coordination now goes through this kind of filter of private public relations firms. And you mentioned Hill & Knowlton, but there's certainly many more. And Hill & Knowlton plays, as we know now, a central role, for example, in selling the Iraq War through the media.
The first round of the Iraq War with the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter. Hill & Knowlton was the PR firm hired to coach.
Right, the famous babies on the incubators story that turned out to be a total media hoax.
Yeah, well, that's right out of George Creel and Eddie Bernays' book with the Belgians ripping arms off of German babies in World War I.
Right, exactly. And this whole fake news thing of creating a media scare, media events, and then in the case, for example, of the first Persian Gulf War, actually creating the impetus to invade a country was the work of the CIA through this privatized network of public relations firms. And aside from the close relationship between the CIA and the media companies, yes, there is this other side that we don't really see much of, which is the propaganda machine working by the public relations companies. And that's something that also I hope will be exposed more in the future as well.
Well, the fake news and propaganda, I mean, for Noriega in Panama, certainly Gaddafi in Libya, Saddam Hussein, they were all related to Hitler. They called each of those a Hitler-like dictator. And it's almost like the same theme that they continue to use, and they use it in Syria today.
Right. It happens over and over again. And if we look closely, we can see a pattern here, which is what you look for when you're trying to kind of find bias in the media, is a pattern of repeated assertions of this being a bad guy, this person being a bad guy, this guy. That before Osama bin Laden, it was Saddam Hussein. Before Saddam Hussein, it was Noriega. And it just repeats itself. It plays out over and over again.
Bin Laden fit right into the program and was connected to the CIA back to the Mujahideen.
He certainly was, but got on the wrong side of the CIA after a while, or the U.S. government, and that was the end of him. It does go on, and it's disheartening that the media forgets everything that happened before and plays up the next big scare and the next big enemy.
Well, Kennedy certainly played the wrong side of the Dulles brothers in the CIA, it seemed, and David Talbot writes about that at length in The Devil's Chessboard.
That's right. Kennedy did kind of censure Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, for his handling in the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. And that was not well accepted by Alan Dulles.
Well, he was sacked, essentially. And then Kennedy wanted to break up the organization. And he said he wanted to splinter it into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds.
That's right. And that did not settle well with the CIA or Alan Dulles. And as David Talbot writes so well in The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles continued to pull the strings of the CIA even after he had been removed from power. So it certainly did not stop when one person was removed from the top position. The machine grinds on. The relationship from the press and the media go on. And even after Alan Dulles retired, there was this close relationship between him and the New York Times and the Washington Post, as a matter of fact. So it just continues on and on.
Brian Covert, as we keep riffing, the mighty Wurlitzer plays on. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to The Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are joined today by journalist and author Brian Covert. He's a longtime contributor as well to the Project Censored books over the years. The topic for today is the CIA and the media in the United States. We'll continue our conversation with Brian Covert after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, the topic on the Project Censored Show is the Mighty Wurlitzer, where it's on the CIA and the media in the United States. And we're joined by author and independent journalist Brian Covert from Japan, longtime contributor to Project Censored. And he wrote a chapter on this very issue for Censored 2017, our 40th anniversary edition. Brian Covert, before the break, we were talking a little bit more about public relations firms. And Peter Phillips had talked about the outsourcing of this kind of program, this Wurlitzer, the Mockingbird style of the CIA embedded in the newsrooms and so forth. And we had mentioned the first Gulf War and Hill and Knowlton. And I wanted to point out two things briefly and have your reaction to this. And that is, Peter Phillips writes about Hill and Knowlton and others in his chapter of Censored 2017 that we wrote about. But there was a really important point in the piece that was emphasized, that the CIA is actually prohibited from disseminating propaganda inside the U.S., right? And John Stockwell had some terms for this, and other researchers, you know, traced this kind of thing back to the agency, and this kind of thing is illegal. But while the use of U.S. media by the CIA has long been documented, the covert involvement of public relations firms may be news to many. That was a quote from Covert Action Quarterly, and I wanted to bring that up in the context of the second Gulf War with the Rendon Group, John Rendon, and the selling of the war in WMDs. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that? That seems, again, right out of the playbook, this selling of war and the use of tax money to hire private firms like the Rendon Group to manufacture consent, as it were.
That also continues on. The Rendon Group and Hill and Knowlton, all of it is part of this web of privatization of propaganda that we've seen in recent years. And certainly the current war in Iraq could not have gotten off the ground without it. There's just no way it could have been sold to the public. And people were actually quite open with how it was sold, that we needed to tell the American people about what was going on in the war so that we could get public support for it. So this very disconcerting acceptance of privatization of propaganda as something that we need to do. We just need to do it because we need to get the public behind this war. And I'm afraid that probably will be the wave of the future, unless, of course, it is exposed. But the privatization of propaganda, of news sources, has certainly taken the place of what used to be almost exclusively the realm of the CIA, which is now, of course, as you said, outsourced. So we don't see the relationship between the CIA and those private companies quite as clearly as we do with some of the media companies.
Brian Covert, you've been based in Japan for a very long time. How do you see the Japanese media? Are they influenced by the CIA, the Japanese security state? And how is Trump being perceived in all of this as we move forward?
Well, the Japanese media is very heavily influenced by what the American corporate press writes. That's the first source that the Japanese corporate press turns to when they want to find out what's going on, is they look at what the U.S. corporate press is writing about, and then they cover it from there, which is actually a bad example to set, but that's how things work. And the situation with the deep state is Japan does have its kind of murky things going on, but not quite as bad yet as what is going on in the U.S. But the relationship between Trump and the current Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, is kind of up in the air at the moment. People are not quite sure what Trump is going to do here in Japan, but it seems that Trump will probably not have much problem relating to Shinzo Abe, who we could consider probably the Japanese version of Donald Trump, very right-wing nationalist prime minister who is really pro-America and is not fully fond of freedom of the press. He recently had passed through the parliament a state secrets law, which punishes whistleblowers with a 10-year prison term if they leak state secrets out into the public, and any journalist who reports that will get 5 years of prison. So there's this chilling effect that's going on as we speak in Japan, and this situation with Fukushima probably is the most noticeable effect of that, is that we're not seeing not nearly as much news stories coming out about Fukushima now that we used to see, at least at the beginning of the crisis, due to the State Secrets Act, which is now in effect. Fukushima has fallen off the front pages of the Japanese press, and every once in a while gets printed as a story whenever the government has something to say about Fukushima or whether the operator of the Fukushima plant has something to say. Then it gets reported, but no, we're not seeing much of Fukushima anymore, and there is this kind of chill in the air due to the state secrets law, which is probably much worse than anything in the U.S. at the moment. Whatever the U.S. might have is probably not quite as bad as we have in Japan yet. So the Japanese press is intimidated, that's for sure, and there's not a lot of hopeful signs that the Japanese press will try to kind of buck the system and risk going to prison just to get the information out. There's not quite that devotion to independence of the press yet in Japan, but let's hope that there will be in the future.
The long-term policy from the U.S. of the containment of China and what's called Obama's pivot, mobilizing U.S. naval forces and military essentially to surround China. Japan, I believe, is a major part of that. Japan has been talking about remilitarization, even mentioning the possibility of building nuclear weapons. How is that being perceived there, and what's your take on the pivot?
Yes, President Obama promised there would be this pivot toward Asia, especially with Japan as a partner with the U.S. in keeping China under control. Japan, for its part, certainly wants to do that. It has been wanting to do that since the end of World War II, but has been constrained in that by Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which actually prohibits the buildup of military and a military force, which Japan has anyway in the form of what it calls the self-defense forces. But it seems like the Cold War tensions between especially China and Japan and other neighbors in this part of the world has now been revived in recent years. President Obama, who was supposed to be a liberal U.S. president, and Shinzo Abe, who was most certainly a far right-wing president, found common cause in this Asia pivot. And now we see, as I say, the sense that the Cold War is being revised again in this part of the world, and Japan is devoting more resources. It just passed another budget and raised military spending even higher than it already was. Japan is like the number five or six highest nation in the world with the highest military budget. Most people don't know that, but Japan plays a key role in the so-called stabilization of countries like China and, to some extent, Russia. But the U.S. certainly couldn't do much without the cooperation of Japan, that is for sure.
Brian Covert, we don't want to stay on Japan too long. I want to get back to the CIA, and I want to get back to the work you've done over the years on legendary reporter Gary Webb. But just a last shot on Japan. In Okinawa, we saw some things happening, some changes. I know Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone have written about this, and certainly Peter Kuznick writing about it again, about the Abe government and some things in Okinawa. Anything to add to that?
Yes, the southern islands of Okinawa, which are down at the bottom of Japan's archipelago, are the home of the largest U.S. bases in this part of the world. Okinawa is a very crucial part of the U.S. war on terror, that's for sure. That's where most military people go from their boot camp in the United States to Okinawa, and then, for example, on to Vietnam, on to Iraq, on to Afghanistan. So Okinawa plays a very central role in continuing the war at that level. And there's still a lot of use of Okinawa for military bases, and there's a lot of protest and demonstrations going on even today against the U.S. bases in Okinawa. There are arrests going on almost daily, protests there. And sometimes even the Japanese mainland press does not really cover the Okinawan issue much. But it goes on, and the U.S. is continuing to expand. It wants to build a new military base in part of Okinawa called Hinoko, Hinoko Bay. And the local people, the local indigenous Okinawan people, are against it. And the government of Japan is for it. The U.S. is pushing it. So it will probably go through in the long run. But there is this kind of division right within Japan over the U.S. military bases. The government of Japan is pushing for it, and a lot of people don't want it, but that has been the nature of the relationship between Japan and the U.S. since the days of the Cold War. The U.S. military bases, as Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone have pointed out, have never left Japan. They've been here since the end of World War II, and in fact, they've grown in size. And it's not likely that the U.S. will give that up anytime soon.
I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and our guest is Brian Covert, an independent journalist, an author, and a professor. We'll continue our conversation after this musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are joined by independent journalist and author Brian Covert. He's a longtime contributor to Project Censored's books over the past years. We're talking about the press, the CIA, and the subversion of truth. Now, Brian Covert, I bring up these strategies of tension, certainly something that the CIA had long pushed in various guises, and I want to bring that back to media. You mentioned that the mainland press in Japan hasn't covered much of what's going on there in Okinawa, certainly doesn't get a lot of coverage here in the United States, these movements of resistance against empire. All right, that doesn't seem to fit into the narrative. And I wanted to use that as a segue into one of your ongoing topics of research, which is the journalist Gary Webb, the late journalist Gary Webb, who was one of the people that early on really helped break the story of the CIA drug importation crack cocaine explosion in the 1980s. He was writing about it in the 1990s. Project Censored had covered that, turned into a book with Seven Stories Press, our publisher, Dark Alliance. And again, that was on the backdrop of the Cold War, on the backdrop of a lot of media propaganda in Central America. Can you comment on some of this and some of your reflections on the work of Gary Webb and that very issue?
Yes, I wrote about Gary Webb and Dark Alliance in Censored 2016, and it was something I felt very strongly about, that we needed to put all of this in context of what Gary Webb was covering. Gary Webb is now proven, despite all the discrediting that it went on by the big media companies, specifically the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, Gary Webb has been proven correct. And what he wrote about then has never been disputed. It can be even backed up even more now than it used to be, but Gary's work will stand the test of time. I've written about that, and I truly believe it. I had a chance to actually interview Gary Webb as part of a TV documentary that I was involved with some years ago. We took a small TV crew over to the States and did some interviews, and definitely I wanted to get Gary Webb in there. This was just in early 1997, as the peak of the Dark Alliance controversy had kind of subsided. And Gary laid out his story very well, and was hopeful that he would be able to get the rest of his stories into the San Jose Mercury News about the CIA, crack cocaine, and the Contras in Nicaragua. It turns out that his sense of optimism was a bit misplaced because the San Jose Mercury News not only did not run Gary Webb's stories, but pushed him out of the company, and that eventually led to his taking his own life, which was a very tragic end to the whole thing. I tried to get that into the Japanese press as well, and somehow that did not make it to the TV screens here in Japan. They were just not interested in covering things like the CIA and drug trafficking, unfortunately. But what else is new, right? The U.S. press doesn't cover it either. So that's one of the taboo topics that I talk about to the students that I teach, is that every country's media has its own taboos. And the primary taboo of the American press is the relationship between the CIA and, for example, international drug trafficking. It's just something that the U.S. press, since Gary Webb, would not go near, and Gary Webb had a lot of courage to actually dive right into that and expose it.
Gary Webb went right to the core of it and actually was supported by the San Jose Mercury News until, well, one only imagines, a phone call came in to Jerry Seppos, or someone was tapped on the shoulder from somewhere on high or within the deep state, and they really pulled the plug on Gary Webb. They really ditched his career in a lot of ways, and arguably ruined his life.
That's right, and we don't know whatever happened. Seppos has never come out. Gary Webb's former boss, Jerry Seppos, has never set the story straight on what happened, and it would certainly did not stop at Gary Webb. Those of us who work in journalism and are doing investigative work also felt that slap in the face being put out to dry by your own
chilling
company.
Effect.
Right, the chilling effect. If it could happen to Gary Webb, it could happen to other people. And it did happen to other people. That was the thing that we need to keep in mind, was around that same time as Gary Webb being hung out to dry by the San Jose Mercury News, other news companies were doing the same thing to their reporters. So there was idea that the reporters cannot go too far with their investigation. Otherwise, you're going to hit a brick wall within your own company, and you'll possibly lose your job or even your career. That's very disheartening, but Gary Webb's work, regardless of that, will stand the test of time, and I think that's something that we all need to keep in mind, that what he wrote was right, what he wrote was correct, and it will stay that way, and hopefully it will be expanded on in the future.
And kudos to Dan Simon and our publishers at Seven Stories Press that published that book, Dark Alliance, to get that out there. And then, of course, actually, we're back to Nick Scal, who wrote Spooked. He actually did the screenplay for the movie, Kill the Messenger. So that story actually is starting to see more of the light of day in the past few years. And we certainly hope, as you do, Brian Covert, that not only will that stand the test of time, but more people will be aware of this kind of thing. And that's actually what we're trying to do on the program today, is call more and more attention to this kind of deep state control of media, certainly in this case, specifically CIA and history of the media. And you also wrote about the CIA's hand in the Mandela arrest decades ago. You've written again with Project Censored about the war on whistleblowers. Obama has gone after more whistleblowers than any president. And so I wanted to wrap our discussion today with this. Over the last 8 years in the United States, we've certainly seen, culminating in this current fake news flap, we've certainly seen attacks on the press. We've certainly seen multiple failures of corporate media, or we could say successes, given that they are principally commercial propaganda arms of the deep state. That's their purpose, actually. But what we wanted to do here, too, is just maybe get your two cents on, given that Obama has certainly not been friendly with the press, the incoming Trump administration has just been outright hostile toward the press. In fact, Trump claiming that he was going to be changing libel laws and so forth, and that the floodgates should be opened against the press, that they have too much freedom. Your thoughts?
President Obama will leave a legacy of having raised the war on whistleblowers to the highest level it's ever been. And then he'll leave the stage, and Trump will come in and no doubt continue that war on whistleblowers, and not only whistleblowers, but the corporate press and independent press. So I'm afraid that we have some dark days ahead of us with the Trump administration coming in. But despite all of that, there is hope that online independent organizations will continue to do their role, which they have been doing well. The Intercept comes to mind, and others, and that the press will find its backbone and stand up to Trump and not let him bully the press into backing away from its primary responsibility, which is reporting the truth and standing as a pillar of freedom in a democratic society. And we've got our work cut out for us, that's for sure, with Trump coming in.
Well, indeed, and this latest assault on non-corporate outlets, this whole idea behind the fake news attack with that prop or not site that the Washington Post uncritically ran, the whole idea is to try to shut down alternative means of information, shut down parts of the internet. Of course, there's still struggles for net neutrality that go on. And so it's true, Brian Covert, we face many challenges ahead, but it's also heartening. And that Project Censored every year, we celebrate the intrepid journalists and we celebrate the work of key scholars like yourself that really go a long way into showing by example what a free press does in a free society. So we certainly thank you for your work and your support over the years, not just with Project Censored, but as an educator. We know you've been very active in this for a very long time. Your work is available at projectcensored.org. We have some of your work posted there, and we will certainly direct readers to that so they can learn more about your work. Is there any other website or other things you'd like to share with our listeners today, Brian Covert?
I don't have any other sources online to share with readers, but just have them go to the Project Censored website and to support Project Censored. Kudos as well to Project Censored for 40 years of fighting the good fight, and journalists and whistleblowers and other academics like myself are grateful for the presence of Project Censored and the work it has been doing for 40 years, four decades on, and will hopefully continue to do for a long time. I encourage readers to continue to support Project Censored because in these times, it's often the only way we can get some truth out there.
Brian Covert, certainly Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director and Co-Editor, and I both thank you for the work that you've done for us, and we certainly look forward to more collaborations ahead. And again, certainly we have a lot to do together here in this new year. So Brian Covert, thanks so much for joining us. The topic today has been played by the mighty Wurlitzer, the press, the CIA, and the subversion of truth. Brian Covert, thanks for coming back on the Project Censored show.
Thank you, Mickey, and thank you, Peter.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our longtime producer is Anthony Fest. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Project Censored airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about it, contact us through projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in our